Hi guys, I have got a huge week. Maybe not so much in terms of all the content, but certainly in terms of the big topic I'm going to talk about in just a moment. Firstly, where I am is in Rockhampton. And for those of you not from Australia, Rockhampton is in my home state. It's in Queensland, which is nice. And just in case you're going, oh, it's in your home state, maybe it's not too far. Queensland is our second largest state. And just for context, in the US, I know everyone likes to go, oh, Texas is really big. No, this is big. 2.5 times the size of Texas here in Queensland. And that's not the biggest state either. We've got Western Australia still, which is about another 50% larger again. So I flew yesterday from Brisbane, which is about an hour drive away from my home, up here to Rockhampton, and that's about an hour and a bit flight. It's probably about, I think it's around a quarter of the way up the state, which gives you a bit of a sense of scale. And I'm here doing a workshop for Central Queensland University. Which is cool. So this is a bunch of people who are responsible for managing the IT systems, building software, doing all the rest of that sort of thing. And it's also especially cool. There's a little bit of me that goes, I really like the idea of this because this is people that are in an environment where other people are learning and maybe it's going to influence things a little bit and we'll maybe get a little bit better at this whole security thing because it's the right sort of environment where people do learn this sort of stuff. So I've been there yesterday doing the first day of the workshop. Again today, it's just after 6 a.m. here in the morning, so it's a nice sort of early quiet start. And I was actually meant to be here next week. And actually, here was my grand plan, right? This is where the year was going to end. I was going to come to Rockhampton next week, home state. As you can see, it's a very nice environment. I'll give you a little walk around at the end of this too. And that was going to be a nice, quiet, easy end of the year, and I'd be laying in the pool with the kids or doing something relaxing. And then the Congress thing came up. And of course, that's what I really want to talk about today, to give a little bit more context to what this thing is and what I'm doing. So I had been speaking to some people House Energy Commerce Committee. Anyway, some folks in Washington who are involved in putting big issues in front of Congress. And I had been having a chat with them going back some weeks now about the whole Equifax thing, because obviously Equifax is big news. It was a massive data breach in terms of both the number of people impacted and the nature of the impact, because this is all like, you know, credit data and this sort of thing. It's very, very sensitive stuff. And I'd been having a chat to those guys. They're very, very nice people. We'd had a number of calls and they had wanted to talk to me about data breaches, because as it turns out, I do spend quite a bit of time speaking about data breaches. Well, certainly thinking about data breaches. And obviously some of the things I had to say were useful. So they approached me a few weeks ago and said, hey, how about you come to Congress and testify? I was like, wow, that sounds pretty impressive. You know, I'm Australian and I'm like on the other side of the world and everything. But anyway, we worked out all the logistics of this. And that's what it now is. I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. next week when I was meant to be here doing the workshop. So big apologies again to Central Queensland Uni. So I'll be in Washington doing the testimony. And I want to give a little bit more context to what it's about. And I wrote a blog post and I announced it. When was this? About 48 hours ago. Announced about 48 hours ago before time of recording. This thing will go out in about 12 hours from now. And said, look, I'm testifying. What should I say? And in fact, I'm going to flick over to some of my notes here because I want to make sure I hit some really important points here. Said, look, I'm testifying. What should I say? And I sort of gave a little bit of context where I said the actual hearing, and I want to make sure this is clear because this is where some people have gone on a bit of a tangent. The actual hearing is about identity verification in a post-breach world. Now, what they're sort of saying here is that we're having an awful lot of data breaches out there. Everyone knows this. They watch this podcast. We know that this is a massive thing. We know it's a problem. What does that mean for the way we identify and verify people? So, for example, and this is part of what's actually in my testimony, I was helping my dad set up a new broadband plan recently. We're getting a faster networks in Australia. So I was speaking to Telstra about the NBN. And he calls up Telstra and they're like, okay, you know, thank you, Mr. Hunt, for calling up, etc. We just need to make sure that you are who you say you are. What's your birth date? And I'm just going, oh, shit. You know, like, it's the thing that people know about when they come and give him cake. And it's the thing that some people, well, a lot of people, put on social media. Dad doesn't, but he's of that generation. Mind you, I don't either, but that's because I know it's used for security questions. It's also the same thing that we get leaked consistently out of systems. Mine was leaked out of the Red Cross Blood Service data breach in Australia just last year. So you sort of see the problem here. Using known static attributes of someone's person as a means of verifying that the other person that knows them is likely the person that they're trying to tell you that they are, is kind of like a pointless exercise. So this is what the hearing is about. The hearing is about how do we do identity verification in an era of so many data breaches. Now, I wrote this blog post and said, you know, like, what should I say? And I had many, many good comments, but I just want to set that scene first. This is about the impact of data breaches on identity verification. So for me, my role there, and there's a couple of other witnesses that will do other things, but my role is very much around, this is what's happening with data breaches. This is why we need to have the discussion about changing our identity verification models. So I am really focusing on trying to set the scene of data breaches. I had many absolutely sensational responses to this blog post about how do we fix data breaches? How do we make companies more accountable? How do we solve the data breach problem? I would love to be asked back to help solve the data breach problem at another time. This is, let's establish the data breach problem. So here's what I've got, and this is all going into the written testimony, which will go out 48 hours in advance. So I'll have that out sometime around early next week, probably mid next week, Oz time. And then there's going to be a subset of this, which is distilled into a 5-minute speech. Now, so what I talk about? I talk about data breach vectors. Breakfast? See, it's early here. Data breach vectors. And what I wanted to establish here is that there is malicious intent, which is one thing. Someone goes and exploits a SQL injection vulnerability or direct object reference or something like that. You know, they go and they exploit a weakness in the design of the system. There is also literally publishing your data to the internet. So we have these cases which are effectively system misconfigurations, whether you publish a backup to a web server with directory listing enabled, or whether you don't have any password on your MongoDB and it's sitting in a publicly facing network segment. So these things are very much configuration issues that are simple mistakes, but they have dire consequences. And the other side of this as well is that we're seeing systems increasingly, which by design leak data, because that's part of what they're meant to do. So for example, in Have I Been Pwned, there is the GeekedIn data breach. Now, you know, data breach is almost even a little bit of a liberal term in this case, because this was loads of publicly exposed data on GitHub scraped together, aggregated, such that it becomes something valuable to another entity. So there's different sort of breaches. The timing of this is just amazing. I wrote this, and then I published this, and then about an hour later, I heard the Uber news. We're going to talk about Uber too. Data breaches can take years to discover. And the point I'm really trying to make here, and incidentally, I don't name any names in this testimony. I'm not going, yeah, Adobe did this and LinkedIn did that and all that sort of stuff. You guys know that, but I'm going to keep those names out of the testimony and then I can provide them at question time. There's a question time as well, by the way, a couple of hours of questions. So I didn't want to talk specifically about companies, but we have seen so many incidents where companies have a data breach and it takes years to disclose it. And in the testimony, I actually make the point, we are all in data breaches we are yet to know about. And again, this was before I knew about the Uber situation. And I've got to sort of think about how I maybe weave that into next week's testimony. I'm a little bit tempted to even say, look, we're all in data breaches we don't know about. I wrote that a week and a half ago, before another data breach that I'm in, that I didn't know about at the time. And you see, where I'm going here is that we have no idea how bad it actually is. I didn't know I was in the Disqus data breach until a few weeks ago. I had someone give me another one this week, which has probably got a lot of you in it because there's a 7-figure number of people and it's the sort of service a lot of you would use. So we don't know how bad it is. And when you think about that as it relates to identity verification, we know it's bad, but it could actually be worse than what we actually know. It's the unknown unknowns, if you like. Now, I've also gone on, so look, we've actually created a bit of a perfect storm of data exposure. And I talk about things like, and this is exactly the same line I've given to journalists for years. We've got cloud computing, which has become so ubiquitous, and is so awesome. I run Have I Been Pwned on all the cloud things. You know, it's a great, great service. The thing is it makes it really easy for anyone to put anything on the internet, so anyone does. Cost barrier is down, usability barrier is down, all of the things that made it hard to get stuff on the web have been reduced. So we get all sorts of stuff on there. I mean, we've seen things even just recently. The Pentagon apparently had an open S3 bucket with all sorts of things in it. You know, good example. So we've got that factor. We've also got the factor of the emerging prevalence, I guess, of IoT. So we've now got all of these devices collecting data of classes that we've never had before. And all you got to do is look at things like some of the adult toys where people have been had their data. Just incidentally, just don't connect that stuff. Do not put that stuff on the internet. But people have had their usage data stored by the provider of the toy. And this is what I mean by sort of classes of data that we have never had digitized before, now suddenly being turned into bytes and stored on the cloud. Things can go wrong. We have seen many IoT things go wrong. We've seen cloud pets go wrong. We've seen the Nissan Leaf able to control cars. We've just seen all sorts of terrible stuff. So there's that side of things. Now, noisy birds in Oz too in some places. Okay, so data maximization. Now, this is a really big thing, and particularly for the folks in Europe who are conscious about the upcoming GDPR in May, the concept of data maximization/minimization is a very important thing. And what's actually great about GDPR is GDPR is saying, let's just collect what we need for a specific purpose and not keep it for longer than what we need it. This is very different. Could you shut up, bird? This is very different to the premise that many organizations work on, which is that we want to have as much data as possible, because the more data we have about people, the more analysis and analytics we can do, the more things we can sell them, the more we can monetize our customers. Someone left me a comment, which I promise you is going to go into definitely the written speech, and I'm trying to get into the oral speech as well, along the lines of, many organizations think of data as an asset when in fact it can also be a liability. I reckon that is a great soundbite, so thank you very much for submitting that. So that was really cool. Now, the other thing here is I want to talk about the extent to which breaches are distributed. Now, this is news to many people, and it certainly was news when I was speaking to the folks over in DC in the lead up to this. And I said, you know that once a data breach happens, there is an entire scene trading it. There are people with stashes of hundreds, sometimes even thousands of data breaches sitting there in file systems, sharing them with each other. Sometimes they're just sitting there on the clear web, literally in a folder with directory listing enabled. Here, help yourself. Other times they're people sharing screen caps of this is my personal stash, and now I'm going to swap it and exchange it. Very often children, very often young adults, very often no real good reason to have the data. It's like, maybe I'll have an enemy one day and I'll need to know their password or something, or maybe I'm checking a friend, or maybe I'm just practicing a bit of hash cracking or something like that. So if you want to practice hash cracking, go and get the 300 odd million hashes from Pwned Passwords. Don't go and get someone else's data. So anyway, there's all of these people that are just sharing data around, and the point I really want to drive home here is that this stuff replicates like wildfire. So when we think about personal data attributes such as birth date, which are in so many of those vBulletin breaches because for some reason they want your birthday when you sign up, and no, it's not copper, that doesn't make any sense. And let me clarify that, because otherwise someone will ping me on that. Copper is to make sure that you're not you're 13 or older. You can ask the question, are you 13 or older? And then if people say, no, you've got to ask the birthday, discard it. Don't save it in the bloody database. I think a lot of the time it's because it's sort of partly because of this data maximization concept of let's just get all the things that we can. And it's also partly because they want to do stuff like send birthday newsletters. That's just so that I can send you another piece of spam email on your birthday, please give us something which is used to verify your identity. By the way, it might be leaked because it's vBulletin and we're never going to actually patch it. We'll just leave it sitting out there on a cheap hosting server somewhere. Not bitter at all. So this is the problem, really broadly distributed data breaches. Now, the other thing here as well is the immutability of exposed data. So what we mean by this, in case this is an unfamiliar term to you, something that is immutable cannot be changed. So if my birthday gets leaked, that's it. You know, it's leaked. Once it's out there and it's well and truly public, and I don't think mine is well and truly public at the moment. Yeah, once it is out there and it's well and truly public, you can't change your birthday, you can't change your mother's maiden name. You're almost certainly not going to change your physical address. You're very unlikely to change your email address if you didn't want to share that with people. Your job history, all the sorts of things that are often used as sort of identity verification questions, these cannot be changed. So this is a really concerning thing, and I sort of make the point in here as well that the mutable data, so the things which we can change, are things like credit cards. So if your credit card gets compromised, you can change your credit card. You can get another number and nobody will know what it is. And yes, there's a monetary impact there, but banks are generally very good at fraud detection. And this is from my own experience multiple times over, predominantly from my wife getting her card owned. They will refund the money, they will give you a new card in the mail this week. And the biggest drama that we have had on these multiple occasions of credit card fraud is going through and changing direct debits, which is not much in the scheme of things. So this is sort of the irony, right? Like the mutable data, the things you can change, is the very thing that organizations stand up and go, hey, you know, Ashley Madison scenario. Hey, look, it's terrible. We got breached. All your sexual preferences are out there. Your wife's gonna leave you. Your kids will never see you again. Good news, your credit card is okay. Shit, you can see why we have a problem here. The other thing is the irrevocability of exposed data. So once this data leaks and there are breaches out there, this stuff is gonna cycle. It's gonna go out there, it's gonna go into so many different places, which is the distribution point before, you're never gonna get it back. After Ashley Madison in particular, I had so many people say to me, can you help me get my data off the internet? And I won't use this term in that very, very formal setting, but it is like trying to get pee out of a pool. It's just not gonna happen, right? Like it is a one-way street. So I want people to be really aware of that. It is taking masses of photocopies. Someone else used the term photocopy as well. I think I might use that because it's very relatable. Taking masses of photocopies and like literally just dropping them out of a plane sometimes. They're just all over the place. So you can't get this stuff back. And that's really, really important. So, I mean, think about the way that's shaping up. You can't change it. You can't get it back. It's out there forever. You don't know how much of it is out there. And right about now, you should be starting to go, and hang on, like we use this as a means of assurance to establish that you are who you say you are. That doesn't sound like a very good idea anymore, does it? I go and I talk about the power of OSINT data. Now, for those of you not familiar with that term, OSINT is open source intelligence. This is the ability to go to LinkedIn and find a lot of info about people and Facebook and all sorts of other resources, not necessarily just social media, that have information about people. And the reality of it is today, we can go to so many different locations and find information about so many people. Now, this is something that is becoming a bigger problem, largely due to the fact that we have so many people now that have never known a time without internet. In my bio, I mentioned I've been building software since 95. So I first saw the internet when I started uni in 95, and that was the first year I started building HTML and bits and pieces. So I've had 22 years worth of sort of seeing this internet evolve. There are people younger than that who are now very, very good professional developers who have never really known a time without the internet, without sharing. And many of them may be privacy conscious, but they have never sort of had to think about a time where we just don't share this data or where it isn't a social norm to share this data. So OSINT data is enormously valuable, and I want to put that in there. This is not data breach. This is not like something has gone wrong. This is that there's just a lot of data out there. And it speaks to the power of aggregation. Once we tie all of this together, stuff from data breaches, stuff that's leaked because websites put your information out there, the OSINT stuff, which is pretty much the same sort of thing, you start to now have this picture of so many different data attributes that are available to build a robust image of what someone's identity is. Is one of the things I want to do with Have I Been Pwned, actually, one of the things that's still on my roadmap is to give better visibility to all the different places that your data has been leaked and all the different attributes so that you can almost go, in my mind, there's like a picture of you and it's like, here's all the attributes that have been leaked and then here's all the places that each one of those has been leaked from. I think that'll be quite impactful. That could actually be a good use of the API if anyone wants to do that. So that's an aggregation problem as well. I do make a specific point around aggregation. And then finally, the resultant impact on KBA. So effectively saying, basically what I just did, like how can we actually do identity verification reliably when this is out there. Now, very coincidentally, this has happened not long after the South Africa incident as well. So the master deeds data breach, where basically everyone in the country was in this data. And, you know, that is obviously unrelated to the US, but just on that also, and I'm not sure how, I mean, okay, they're US lawmakers, but this is a global thing. Your data gets exposed from global systems. We go onto the internet, we don't necessarily know where a service is hosted. We put our data in. That service sits under some local jurisdiction. That could be entirely independent to the jurisdiction that we're talking about in DC next week. So it is a big, big problem, a worldwide problem. We'll see how they want to deal with it in the US. A couple of things I am going to add based on feedback. And again, there's a lot of feedback about stuff which is super, super awesome, but tangential to the nature of the hearing. I do want to touch on the accountability thing though, because many, many people said, we've really got to talk about organizations being accountable. And I think the way I'm going to put this is that the lack of accountability means that these data breaches are, basically there's not enough incentive for them not to happen. And because they're happening so much, then we have the KBA identity verification thing. So let's talk about Uber, because this plays directly into the Uber story. Now, if you have not heard what happened with Uber, and this is just another one of these things where it's like life is normal and then suddenly all hell breaks loose with reporters and news and everything else. So Uber, about 48 hours ago before recording this, so about 60 hours before you see this go live, news came out, I think it originally came from Bloomberg, about Uber having been hacked last year and 57 million people being in the breach. And on the surface of it, this is like a business as usual sort of story as far as data breaches go, right? It's just another one of these incidents. It's the nuances of the Uber story that make it really interesting. And the first is, apparently someone had AWS credentials in a GitHub repository, in a private GitHub repository. Now, we all know you shouldn't do that. We all know that we probably have at one stage or another put something sensitive in a repository and then we rely on the fact that it's meant to be private to save our asses. I'm sympathetic to whoever it was that actually put that in there, because I know there are so many points where it's like, look, it's the easy thing, it solves. You shouldn't do it. I'm just saying I know where you've been. So it's in this GitHub repository. Someone has gotten access to it. Now, there's a question to be answered about who actually or how this threat actor, for want of a better term, got access. I tweeted yesterday, Occam's Razor, and in case you don't know, Occam's Razor basically says that the simplest explanation is the most likely one. So the simplest explanation is someone had an account on GitHub, they had a crap password, or they reused it somewhere else, which is also a crap thing, and they didn't have any multi-step verification, and then someone else got into the repo. Yeah. I don't know if we'll ever see the answer, or the actual true answer, but that's the sort of thing that happens. So someone's got the credentials, gotten into AWS, the news says that they got an archive of data, which sort of implies it was a backup of something from somewhere. So anyway, they've got this backup, 57 million people in there, a whole bunch of info about drivers, including their driver's licenses, and a whole bunch of info about riders, which I assume includes myself. And it sounds like it's got names, email addresses, phone numbers. I'm not sure that I've seen a mention of passwords, but you'd kind of expect that that's the sort of data which is often in a breach like this. So anyway, like all the data out there. Now here's the interesting bit. Apparently, whoever broke in, and I get the impression from some of the wording that it's multiple parties, whoever broke in tried to shake down Uber. Said, give us money. We've got your data, give us money. And Uber paid them $100,000. Now that makes it very interesting, and it makes it very alarming, because it shows that there's an ROI on doing this. You know, when you can be incentivized with cash to break into a system, and you know that there are precedents of organizations paying it, because let's face it, $100,000 for Uber. Now put your evil Uber hat on for a moment. And incidentally, I'm not quite to the Uber is always evil extent that I know many people are, because I like using the service so much. But let's imagine that they're just super, super evil, for the sake of explanation, and they've gone, well, it's either $100,000 or we're probably going to spend at least $100,000 on like incident response and expensive security companies. And then that's before not just the damage to reputation, but then all of the class actions that always follow that, all of the other cleanup that's going to go on. Like, it's going to cost us millions and millions and millions of dollars, probably tens of millions of dollars. One of the figures I've seen around the cost of these things is TalkTalk in the UK said it cost them £42 million to clean up after their data breach. Now, to put that in Aus dollars terms, about 70 million Aus dollars, so it's probably about 58, 60 million USD. Lots of tens of millions. So from Uber's perspective, if they're going, well, on the one hand, there's lots of tens of millions, on the other hand, there's 100 grand, but how are we going to spin it, right? Because we're basically paying criminals a ransom. And all of this is just from what I read, right? So you can go and find the same in for yourself. It's just my aggregated takeaways of the Uber incident. So what it sounds like they've done is they said, well, let's make it a bug bounty. Because if it's a bug bounty, it's not a ransom. And if it's not a ransom, then we're not going to get in trouble because it's just a bug. Well, mind you, they might get in trouble because they should have disclosed, but it's just a bug bounty. So it looks like what they've done is that, again, the press, allegedly, is saying that those involved signed NDAs and got their 100 grand. Now, I find that really interesting because that is like, it's almost like mutually assured destruction if anyone leaks the incident. Like if Uber leaks it and they go, hey, this thing is has happened. Well, let's put it the other way. If whoever's in the NDA leaks it, well, Uber will go, well, we know who you are. We've got your information. Uber definitely doesn't want to leak it because it's going to be a bad story. But of course, a year on, new CEO, Uber's trying to clean up their act. Obviously, they've gone, actually, the right thing to do when someone hacks into your system and takes 57 million records is to disclose it. Now, what'll be interesting is if those guys did sign NDAs and that's there in the paperwork somewhere in Uber, and now this is a big story and it's almost certainly going to involve law enforcement as well, I'd be feeling pretty bloody nervous even with my 100 grand if I was those guys. So, that might have a way to play out yet. But again, going back to the Congress thing for a moment, seeing that sort of behaviour and seeing it just the week before the hearing, like it is going to be interesting next week. I wonder if there are going to be some very Uber-specific questions. All right, so I want to move on because I do actually have to go and I have to get coffee and then run a workshop. So that's the Congress thing. Next week I will publish the entire written statement that I'll be making publicly. That's published publicly by Congress anyway, but I'll put it on my blog. I'll also queue up my oral statement. It is one that I've actually written out. I was thinking originally, look, I'll just wing it and it will be kind of casual. And then I was like, no, look, I've literally got a 5-minute block and I've got to have all the key points hit. So it's written, I'm just going to try and read it and look casual. Maybe it'll work. So anyway, I'll put that out as well after the event. It should be live telecast as well. So I'll try and find the info for that, put that on my blog, on my Twitters and things. And it is recorded and available afterwards as well. That's that. Now, another thing that came up this week, came up yesterday, is have I been pwned in Firefox? Now, this, I actually wasn't expecting this to make as much noise as it was, as it has. So Firefox is incorporating some bits of have I been pwned. And this popped up because it was in one of their sort of feature lists, if you like. And it also links through to a GitHub repository where they've got some more information about it. And what they're sort of doing is saying, look, let's highlight when a site has been breached. Let's say the data does turn up for Uber and it's in have I been pwned and you go to Uber, there'd be some form of visual indicator. Now, people got very, very excited about this. And I think people are also reading this as you will be able to, from Firefox, just immediately search have I been pwned. It will tell you your exposure. There's a bunch of stuff that I've been speaking to Mozilla about, you know, things we can do now and do easily, other things that we want to do or have intentions to do in the future as well. But as of now, it looks like what they've got in this release is just sort of the, you know, this is a site that's been breached. There are loads of other implications about the other stuff. I am really, really happy to see how excited everyone was about the potential, but all the searching and other nuts and bolts that would go into actually being able to tell you where your account has been pwned, that's not in there today. That's some way off if it's something that makes sense at all. I really like working with the Mozilla folks on this because they're out there as a free, not-for-profit organization. They're just trying to do good things. And they have a heap of reach as well. Yeah, Firefox is the world's most, or there's the second most popular browser in the world right now. And that new version they just released, which I just downloaded yesterday, does seem super fast too. So I'm almost a little bit tempted to roll over. I saw someone make a comment this morning about I'm leaving like RAM-hungry Chrome for Firefox now that they've got their super fast speedy one up there. And that actually was like, you know what? It is a RAM-hungry bastard, isn't it? Maybe I should actually have a look at rolling over. So stay tuned with what goes on in Firefox. I think just the sort of community response that's come back helps enormously in trying to figure out what makes sense in the future. But look, hopefully based on that, and hopefully based on the trial of having the sort of which sites have been pwned in there in the browser, will be something that gives us a good indication of what should happen next. So that's that one. Now, I did actually write something this week, other than the Congress stuff too, and I did a bit on my Security Sense column, and this was about you can outsource the work but never the risk. Now, this is kind of interesting because I saw this raised, or rather I saw this said at the McAfee conference last week. So I did like a Twitter chat. And in this Twitter chat, one of the McAfee folks who chimed in made this comment. And in fact, we were talking about cloud services, you know, like you can outsource your hosting to cloud. It doesn't mean that you're not still responsible for your data. So I saw that said last week and it just sort of stuck in my brain. And then during the week, I saw, this is during last week, I saw the Department of Social Services in Australia. They had an incident, a breach. And their comment here, I'm going to read you the statement I put in my notes. They said, the compromise resulted from the actions of the department's third-party provider. I thought, well, that is something we see a lot of, isn't it? So the Red Cross Blood Service, I mentioned this before, external provider. Michael Page, who had their data exposed just a few weeks after the Red Cross, external provider. Many of these incidents are things going wrong with the external provider. And I sort of, in this Security Sense column, make the point that what I used to see back in the day in Pfizer is so much of this attitude of, we'll just chuck it over the fence for vendor, you know? Let's unburden ourselves of these pesky developers who we have to keep paying money to build things. We'll unburden ourselves, we'll chuck it over the fence, we'll find a cheap developer somewhere, other side of the world, low-cost market, job done. Doesn't that website look great? The thing is that as much as that might delegate the responsibility of building software, it doesn't delegate the accountability of if it goes wrong. Because if your software built by a third-party provider does go wrong, then it's going to be your name in the headline. You know, it's going to be your company.org, whatever it is. It is the one that's had the data breach and had the information leaked. So you can't just sort of say, not my problem anymore. And I'm not necessarily saying this is what DSS is saying here, but clearly many of these breach notices do try to direct responsibility over to another party. You just can't do that. Like, it just, it doesn't make sense. The buck is always going to stop with you. Now, some people sort of chimed in and said, all right, well, need more audits, you know? Now, I've been involved in a lot of assessments of vendors, of partners, and the way these assessments tend to work is there'll be like a 12-page document with checkboxes, and then the vendor will go through and go, yep, we do that well, we do that well, we do that well, and it's a self-assessment. And the thing is that when you self-assess, you generally tend to be a little bit self-ingratiating. You know, I was like, of course I do this well. We do a very good job of this. Trust us. It's fine. I always pictured people sort of scurrying around in the background just creating documents in order to sort of then truthfully say that, yes, they have a policy, which is one of the requirements in the self-assessment. Now, that is not an audit as well. Let's be clear about this. A self-assessment is not an audit. Audits are expensive because that's when you get in third parties who are independent and impartial, and they go through your systems and they say what's done well and what's done badly. And because they're expensive, people don't like to do them. So there's got to be a really good reason to have an actual audit, but unless you have an actual audit, the whole premise of doing any sort of assessment doesn't make a lot of sense beyond compliance checkbox checking. So, obviously, I'm not a big fan of trying to delegate things out and just think that everything will be okay and you're not accountable at all. Doesn't really work that way. All right, so last thing on the sponsorship side of things. Mindbody is sponsoring this week. Now, Mindbody makes software for wellness providers. And this sort of sounds a little bit unusual, like, do we really have people wanting to buy wellness things on my blog? It's not that. They're actually using the sponsorship slot as a recruitment tool. So they're looking for security professionals, and this is the first time someone has used the sponsor bar for recruitment purposes. So I'm really happy to see that. And obviously they're looking for the sorts of demographic that come and read this blog. It might be the sort of demographic you are. So really cool to see them up there doing something a little bit different to all the other ones. It was still fantastic, but, you know, great diversity is really interesting. So Mindbody's up there, go and check them out. That may well be something that you are actually interested in. And that pretty much brings us to the end here. The environment that I'm sitting in here, just for context, I mentioned it's Rockhampton, it's up in Queensland. You can hear the birds. What I wanted to do, it always feels weird when there's people walking past, looking at me. Is she gone? Yeah, okay, we can do this. So what I thought I'd do is jump up. I'm gonna try and turn the AE lock off here because otherwise things look really weird, and show you where we are. Now, you see this is a river. Apparently it has crocodiles. I'm not sure if any of those black things there that just look like blurs are crocodiles. Could be crocodiles, I don't know. So this is part of the joy of being in Australia and in Queensland. And again, this is a very, very different environment to what I'm gonna be in next week when I get over to DC. So thank you very much for watching, everyone. I will come to you from somewhere else with probably big buildings and capital things next week. And by then I would have done my testimony as well, so I can tell you what that's like. So yeah, well, next week's gonna be big. Talk to you then. See you guys.